Jumping, throwing a pool party, charging your phone, these are pretty basic activities humans already have a pretty good handle on. But doing things the easy way doesn't help us learn much. But what if we hold that pool party in a swimming pool made of Gruyere cheese, using bottled water with the bottles opened by a nuclear weapon? Okay, no, we wouldn't actually do that, I hope. But by answering the question of how it could be done, we stand to learn a lot. Randall Monroe is the creator of the web comic XKCD. His new book is How To, Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. Randall, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you tackle throughout the book all these kind of basic day-to-day problems, how to jump high, how to build a swimming pool, how to cross a river, but in the most difficult ways possible. What is your goal in trying to think about these weird solutions to everyday problems?
You know, to be honest, whenever I always tend to make things difficult, and deep down I always suspect maybe this will actually make it easier. Like, maybe this will work. I don't go out looking for the worst way to do something. I just try to find a different way of doing something. And, you know, most of the time, ideas that seem bad or ridiculous are bad or ridiculous. But you never really know until you work through them and try to figure out what would happen.
Well, in your intro, you give this example of how to, say, land a big rover on Mars. And one of the ideas that seems outlandish and ridiculous, they actually went with. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. When they were trying to land the rover, Curiosity was much heavier than all the previous rovers they'd sent. And the usual approach of having airbags and parachutes to slow it down wouldn't work in Mars's thin atmosphere. And they came up with all these other ideas, and they thought about putting rockets on the rover to make it land, but it would kick up too much dust, and the system has to land automatically, so it would interfere. And someone had the idea of dangling the robot from what they called a sky crane, which was a hovering rocket-powered platform that would then lower the robot slowly on a rope, like a tether, and set it down gently on the ground while staying high enough up that the rockets didn't kick up dust, and then fly off sideways to crash so it didn't fall straight down onto the rover. And this sounded like the most ridiculous idea, but every other idea that they had was worse. And they tried it, and it actually worked, because, you know, they went over it, they couldn't find any problems, and they were like, okay, I think we can do this. So sometimes, now and then, those ridiculous ideas turn out okay. I mean, like, smearing mold on a cut doesn't seem like a very good idea, but it is how we discovered antibiotics.
You tackle a bunch of different problems, and if it's funny all the way through, but if we're not careful, we might learn a thing or two. I want to get into that swimming pool made of Gruyere. You have a chapter on how to hold a pool party without a pool, and you kind of have this lesson in material sciences with different things we could build a pool out of, from tinfoil to wood. Can you talk about what you were tackling there?
Yeah, well, I don't have a pool, and I was thinking if I had to make one on short notice, how would I do it? And so I got to talk about, you know, in-ground and above-ground pools and how they're constructed. And one thing I really like about science and physics is that you can come up with a formula that shows you the tension in the side of a fiberglass pool, and it'll tell you, you know, is this tension bigger or smaller than the breaking strength of the fiberglass? But physics doesn't care if the questions you're asking it are ridiculous or not. So you can just take that same equation and plug in the tensile strength and density of Gruyere cheese, and it'll spit out, like, here's how thick your pool needs to be to contain the water. And I love that you can just, like, ask a silly question like that, but then you can actually get the answer. Even if it's not useful for really anything in particular in that case, I don't think that's going to be the next landing a rover on Mars.
We're in Wisconsin. I don't know. We've got a lot of cheese to build pools out of. You also
send your own rover.
Exactly. You also look at how to fill that pool, and one solution you look at is, of course, to order thousands and thousands of bottles of bottled water, but then to speed up opening it. What if we used a nuclear weapon? And this is a recurring theme in the book. It sounds ridiculous, but many things that sound ridiculous, the U.S. government has studied. What would happen to, say, a container, a plastic container, a metal container, in case of a nuclear explosion?
Well, this is a thing that the government studied during the Cold War, and I think it's funny that sometimes I'll come up with what I think is a ridiculous idea and then find that some serious researchers have come up with an even more ridiculous one, especially in that early Cold War period when no one really knew where this was all headed, and they were trying out some pretty wild things. But they did test out putting different they said the effect of nuclear weapons on commercially packaged beverages was the title of this long report, where they set out a bunch of beer and soda bottles and under a nuclear test site, and checked how much damage they sustained and whether the drinks inside were still good. And the reason for this they gave was that they wanted to know if these fluids would still be a source of hydration in a cleanup, after a nuclear attack for the emergency response. I sort of wonder, though, they got the beverages, if you read the report, from local retailers. I sort of wonder if the entire project wasn't concocted because someone got caught buying drinks on their government account.
Yeah, no, we're buying all these Cokes for nuclear testing. That's it.
Yeah, exactly. And the bouncy castle is for survivability of impact. Find some engineering words for this.
We're talking to Randall Monroe. His new book is How to Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. Another one that you tackled that I love is, okay, we've got pianos. I'm looking at one right now in our studio. They've got 88 keys. You tackled the question of, okay, what if we wanted a piano that can produce basically any physically producible sound that something might be able to hear or detect? How do you figure out how many keys that piano needs?
Well, there's a pretty straightforward relationship between the frequency of a key and, its ordering. They go up by a set interval. And so this was a question actually someone wrote in and suggested, what if you extend it in either direction? And it turns out it's really fun because the piano can just keep going. After you go, you can go a few dozen keys in either direction and you'll encompass all the sounds that humans can hear, but you can go even farther than that. If you could build a piano like this, you'd have to use something other than strings, because strings don't work very well for producing extremely high frequencies. And for extremely low frequencies, the piano would need to be larger than the building it was in. But there are ways to do it. And so if you built this, you could play sounds that are too low to hear or too high for even bats and dogs to hear. And what's fun is that those sounds would be mixing with all the real high and low frequency sounds that are sloshing around in the in the atmosphere right now. High frequency sounds don't travel very far, but there are low frequency sounds going past us all the time that we can't detect unless we have equipment that can pick up these low, slow pressure waves. But they're caused by things like meteors and machinery and even like volcanic eruptions. And it's neat to realize that there's this sort of music out there that we can't hear.
One drawback, though, would be if we're playing the really low notes, the nuclear weapon detectors around the world might be set off.
Yes, I included a piece of music. If someone does build one of these pianos, it's one of the few things in the book that I think you actually could do fairly straightforwardly. It wouldn't be too difficult or too expensive if you use this rotary woofer. It's a piece of equipment for doing extreme bass notes. But I wrote a piece of music that's many octaves below a normal piano. And you could play it. It wouldn't be audible to people, but it would show up on anyone doing infrasound monitoring. And one of the main groups doing infrasound monitoring is people who are looking for the characteristic air pulse from a secret nuclear test. So you would definitely, if you play this piece of music, I arranged it so that it will draw out a stick figure on their monitoring equipment.
Now, the chapter I was laughing out loud the most at, enough to get attention from colleagues down the hall here at WPR, was how to make an emergency landing. You brought in a special guest. You did a Q&A interview with Chris Hadfield, the famous astronaut and test pilot. And in addition to all his credentials, it seems, Randall, that he's also one of the most patient people on Earth. He really stuck with you through some wild questions.
I think that's my favorite chapter, too. He was just so much fun to talk to. And the funny thing is, he's very, he's an astronaut, so he's very, he's got that air traffic control voice. Everything is always calm, measured, no excitement or, startled, or he never seems taken aback or surprised or anything. It took me a little bit to realize how much he was really enjoying the exercise. I kept on giving him a chance to finish, and he was, I know you have somewhere to be, and he's like, no, let's
keep
get through the rest of these questions. But it was, what was fun was I was expecting that the interview would be, I'd ask him about some things, he'd give me some interesting tips, and I'd write an article, and I arranged my questions from, like, the least ridiculous up to the most ridiculous. you know, starting with some simple questions about like landing in like farmers' fields and unusual places, and then working my way up to you know, landing if you're trapped on the outside of a plane, working the flaps with your hands, or how to land on ski jumps and stuff like that. And to my surprise, and I figured I'd just keep asking him the weirder and weirder questions until he got impatient, you know, and everyone was just like, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever been asked, and hung up on me. But he just answered all of them. I couldn't stump him. You know, and sometimes the answer was like, oh, there's no way to do that. You would, there's no way to make that landing safely. You'll, almost certainly, it won't be survivable or whatever. But a lot of the time he was just like, oh yeah, that's easy. You can do that. Here's how.
Can I spoil the last question you asked him? Because it's how to land a rock. So what if I'm picked up, you write, by a rock, the giant mythical bird? How should I try to force it to put me down without dropping me? And his first line of his answer is, your best bet is to treat it like a big angry hang glider.
Yeah,
I think that's the part where I got a lot of attention from my laughing.
Yeah, I had kept that question like at the end of my notes when I was going
to
call him, because I'm like, well,
we won't get to
I mean,
that.
If I run through everything else and I can't, you know, I guess I can bring out this one. But and I even then I was like, I know this one's outside your area of expertise. But no, he answered it. And what's really wild is reading it. You might think it's, you know, been really, you know, edited down. Here are his concise points. But there would just be no pause. I'd ask the question and he would just launch into the answer, thinking out loud, you know, working through what he'd do in response to being picked up by a giant bird. And I realized that maybe my initial plan of trying to stump a test pilot astronaut by throwing weird situations at them, like that, may have had some flaws. But on the other hand, I am just absolutely delighted by how that turned out. He was a great sport, and that's, I think, my favorite chapter in the book.
As we wrap up, Randall, it seems like you're almost combining the like a childlike sense of wonder and always asking why or what if with the actual science that would answer the what if question. How can the rest of us kind of cultivate that attitude of thinking?
I don't know. You know, I don't really know about, you know, kids and education and stuff, but like, I've really never had the sense that kids are more creative or have more of a sense of wonder than adults. I think the difference to me seems like that kids are less embarrassed about not knowing things, because they don't know, you know, lots of things all the time. And so my secret opinion is that all Q&As after all technical presentations would be better if they were limited to kids under 12. Because no kid, you know, kids, they might not ask questions that they might have an easy answer, they might misunderstand things, but a kid will never say, like, well, I have more of a comment than a question. And they just have good, straightforward questions that they want to know the answer to. You know, and I think it's... The best lesson that I have from all this is just when you don't know the answer to something, even if it sounds like a ridiculous question, just like swallow the pride and ask it. My New Year's resolution was to, when people used words I didn't know, I would ask them what they meant. And it was really weirdly hard, you know. I shouldn't have any insecurities about that, but I really do. So I think letting go of insecurity about not knowing things and asking questions is a great way to go, because everyone's interested in this kind of weird stuff, I think.
Randall, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It was great talking to you.
That's Randall Monroe. He writes the webcomic XKCD. We talked to him about his new book, How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. Coming up, we'll get the latest on Hurricane Dorian and take a look at what else is brewing in the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico. Stay with us here on Central Time.